Welcome to Documentary First, an inside look at a documentary filmmaker's journey. I'm your host, Josh Lindsay from the Movie Proposal Podcast, and with us is our documentary filmmaker, Christian Taylor.
Hey, Josh. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Christian. How are you?
Good.
I got to say, Christian's got a really cool, I don't know if you're listening or watching or not, but Christian's got a cool new setup with her mic, her headphones, awesome new backdrop. She's looking pretty professional while the rest of us look, well, at least Mindy and I look, you know, great. Jason always looks good on his $30,000 camera. But great to see you, Christian.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm in my new booth. I'm so happy that my renovation is moving along and now I can actually start to work from home. That's nice. Anyway.
And laughing in the background is Jason. Hello, Jason. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, good.
I just want to talk about a little bit. If you're not following Jason on Twitter, you are missing a lot of cinema reviews. And a lot of dad jokes. I've been enjoying your cinnamon reviews. He reached 4,000 followers on Twitter this week. And so he did a review of Cinnamon Stuff. And so he's definitely one to watch on Twitter.
Yeah, that was a bit weird. I did cinnamon roll flavored coconut milk, which was terrible. And I couldn't tell until I dumped it out because it was so bad that it is a really odd brown color. And it wasn't good. It wasn't good. That's a spoiler for the review. It's not good.
All right. And also with us all the way from Tennessee is Mindy Cook. Hello, Mindy.
Hello. Hello. So now I'm wondering, does that make Jason our cinematographer?
Yeah, you could do dad jokes too.
I got the dad jokes. Yeah.
As a dad, I'm offended by these jokes. You both need to stop.
As in they're not good enough or they're overshadowing you and you feel like you have to up your game.
Well, I don't feel you have the right.
Oh, okay.
One of you are a father, you know, like
it's true. I am not a father. I will do my best to stop stealing your thunder here.
Thank you. So Christian.
Josh.
So much to talk about today. Do we want to start with an update on the film?
Sure, we can start with an update. It has been a busy week here at The Girl Who Wore Freedom. We are still talking a lot about what we're getting ready for in May and June. And this week has been about getting a DCP made and then shipping it to France. And the process for that has been going through all of our subtitles, making sure that we have a completely subtitled film, partially in English, partially in French, getting that file from Asheville, North Carolina to Nashville, Tennessee, which we did by post. And then James Thayer of Seek Him First Productions in Nashville. James Thayer is our DCP provider. He's been doing that from the beginning. We've sent him a lot of business over the course of 2 years because we've had to have several DCPs produced. And he put those together along with Grueling Glory, the French version and the English version, which he gave us complimentary for all of our business. That was very nice. Thank you, James. And he then put those all on a drive and he shipped those to Michel Coupe in France. And if you've never done this before, it is a process. Making a DCP file is not cheap, nor is it easy. So only a few people sort of specialize in this. So in order to make The Girl Who Wore Freedom DCP file, it cost us $780. So there was some shipping incurred from Nashville to Tennessee, you know, maybe $25. I had to buy a drive. So there was money there spent that could fit this big file. And then James put all three of these. It took about a week for him to get all those files together, put them on a drive. And then he had to take them to the UPS store. It cost us $142 in order to ship it via DHL from Nashville, Tennessee to Normandy, France. So it's almost $1,000 just to get this DCP file to France so that people can watch it this summer. So when you're budgeting to, you know, send your film to film festivals, which is typically why you would need a DCP, or if you are doing a theatrical release, you need a DCP. You definitely need to budget for that. And the way that it typically works is a DCP supplier will take the file and they'll put it on a dedicated drive. And then they will take the responsibility of putting it in a Pelican case with a return shipment label. And so then they would ship it out and then they charge you for the shipping of going there and coming back. And then the theater is supposed to be responsible for taking that drive, putting it into the Pelican case and sending it back. We've run into situations where the theater hasn't really followed through with that, and we have to make sure that that happens. Also, if we then want to take that drive and ship it to a different theater, there's a rental fee now at this point, which is like $30 and for that trip, plus the shipping. So, I mean, there's always costs involved in terms of shipping these DCPs around. So you need to build those into your budget from the very beginning before you start making stuff. So now we're just waiting for it to arrive to Michelle Coupe. She will then become our ferryman, and she will take that DCP to the D-Day experience, where they will ingest the file from the DCP, from the drive, into their, you know, what do you call them, projectors. And then she will take that drive to the Carentan Theater. They will ingest those files into their projectors, and then we'll get the drive back to James in Nashville, Tennessee. So that's the life cycle of a DCP file. And we've been focused on making sure that happens this week. I've been working a lot with several different organizations in New York City to try to get our screenings lined up, as well as with Airbus, and talking with the National Institute or the National Infantry Foundation in Fort Benning, Georgia. It's really possible that we're going to have a screening in Fort Benning sometime in April, in conjunction with my son Hunter just finding out he got accepted into airborne school at Fort Benning, Georgia, where the National Infantry Museum is. So it's a 3-week school, and he's not really started his Navy school, the second version of his Navy school. So he's going to go for 3 weeks, go to airborne school, and at the end of that, have a graduation where he jumps out of a plane and all the family can watch. And so I wouldn't miss that. And so it would be amazing if we could show the film at the National Infantry Museum around that same time. So we're trying to make that work. And we had super exciting news this week at the Girl Who Wore Freedom. Thank you, France, for dropping your vaccine requirement. We now have several people on our staff that can go with us. So, I was worried because, you know, not everybody can get vaccinated. And so it's really limiting if people cannot go because they can't be vaccinated. And I was super sad about that. So we're so thankful to France. Now more of our team members get to go with us to France for the shooting that we're going to do about the Carentan project. So all of that stuff was what happened this week.
So do you have a plan B for that film getting over to France? Because you're talking about all the steps of getting it shipped and your ferryman?
Yes, Michelle is my ferryman.
I mean, what happens if she gets lost? What happens if she, do you have a plan B and C?
Yeah, Michelle is not going to get lost. The DCP could get lost between here and there. Also, the DCP could fail. So that doesn't happen often, but you always do have to have a backup plan. So that's a great question. The backup plan is a Blu-ray disc.
And where will that be?
I'm not sure if I'm going to carry it with me or if I'm going to be sending it over there in advance, but you really do have to have a backup plan. Most theaters, if they play a DCP, will also be able to play a Blu-ray still. So that's what they suggest you use as your backup.
Your story was giving me nightmare flashbacks to when I was interviewing with Big Idea VeggieTales. And one of the interview questions was, hey, we had this real scenario where we're in Chicago, we had a film festival in Orlando, we were going to, preview Larry Boy, but whatever content they were using, it didn't work or it didn't arrive. And, it was like 5 o'clock on Thursday and they're showing it on Friday. And the guy interviewing me asked, like, so what do you do? And I'm thinking, all I could think of is, well, now I'm not getting the job. I have no idea. how am I supposed to know? And I finally said, I have no idea. And he said, well, there are people flying down Friday morning. They'll just take a copy with them. I'm like, I didn't know that. How am I supposed to know you had crew flying down Friday? I was so mad, but I got the job anyway. So anyway,
that's wonderful. Well,
I learned you need to have backup plans.
Yeah, you certainly do. And in the military, they'll tell you, you have to have, you know, an A, B, and C plan, really, for redundancy. And I did learn, I've learned that the hard way on several different occasions. When we made our initial DCP in 2019, which was just of the rough cut, one of our team members here said they could make it. They made it. I took the drive over there. And then the projector at the D-Day experience could not recognize the DCP that had been made. So that was a serious problem because I had veterans coming to that. It was a super huge screening and we had a really tough time. We've talked about this, I think, before with Bill, where we had to track down somebody in France to make a Blu-ray. And that's nearly impossible to do now because they don't make the software to make Blu-rays anymore. So if you don't have the old software for making a Blu-ray, you're SOL. And so fortunately, we were able to find a way to make a Blu-ray. But, you know, there was a skip in that Blu-ray and my heart stopped. Like it was on Henri Jean talking and he just froze and I froze. And I'm like, oh, God, please don't let this happen. And then it just picked up and went along and there weren't any more. But I mean, that's another issue. Like I wanted to get the DCP over there. You have to make sure that theaters will watch that DCP all the way through because there could be mistakes and you could have to do it again. So thinking through those things is super important and you need to give yourself enough time. Most people don't give themselves enough time when they're making a DCP and getting it to the theater to even if you have a backup plan or a what we're going to do next, if you don't have enough time for that, it's a problem. So you always need to build in lots of extra time to make sure if the DCP fails or doesn't arrive, you have a backup plan.
Time and money, those are always the two big issues, aren't they?
For sure.
Well, speaking of time, because we're running out of it and we got to get to Mindy. Mindy is our special guest today. Mindy, how are you?
Doing well, Josh. How about you?
Good. And you're down in Nashville or outside Nashville? Or
I'm inside? In Nashville. Yeah.
Awesome. How's the weather?
It's actually sunny right now, which is pretty great because it was pouring rain today and Nashville is prone to flooding. So I've been hoping that we don't get a whole lot more rain today. That would be really great.
Well, I think everyone from the north is trying to visit Nashville because Nashville is jacking up their prices for hotels right now because everyone wants to get down there and listen to some music, eat some good food.
Nashville's jacking up their prices for everything right now. Rent's through the roof. There are very few homes on the market. the moniker Cashville applies more than ever right now.
So your background is in production and we're talking about cinematography today. Christian, mm-hmm. You want to kick us off and kind of like what direction you want to go in talking about cinematography?
Sure. Well, we have Mindy back here because I don't often have the ability to do a really deep dive into some subjects. And we've neglected cinematography up to this point because our cinematographer for The Girl Who Wore Freedom has not been able to be on the show. And so once we have Mindy here and she's in this process and she's going to be shooting for us going forward, in particularly in our Carentan project, we have this unique opportunity to talk to her about that whole department of cinematography. And before we started with her, I wanted to just ask you and Jason, you know, some projects where the cinematography has stood out to you when you're watching a movie, and I want the listener to think about this too. You know, when you've watched a movie and you've thought it was beautiful or moving or, you know, maybe well shot, I don't know. What movies come to your mind and tell me why you would say I would give that person an award for cinematography? Jason, let's start with you.
Yeah, I think some of my all-time favorite cinematography in films that I've seen, and not necessarily documentaries, would have to be almost everything by David Fincher. I just absolutely love the way that his films almost feel clinical. They almost feel omniscient, like they're God watching the film. And there's some really interesting reasons why that I feel that way. His lighting is very naturalistic but also stylized, so like you can be watching it and feel like, yeah, they're just a couple people in a bar having a conversation, but the more you look at it, the more you're like, wow, this is really meticulously lit to make them feel totally natural but also stand out from everything in the background. And he also does there's a fascinating little the word's escaping me, like a video essay about how he always tracks every little movement of a person. Like if a person shrugs, the camera slightly shrugs with the person. Like he locks in on the characters and sticks with them. And so that really gets you in tune with the characters. You feel like you're there with the characters. And so that's why almost every film by him, in particular, Gone Girl or Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, like they just feel like you're in the room with the characters. And so those have really stuck out to me.
Great insights. I love that. Thank you. All right, Josh, what about you?
Well, I'll answer a different perspective. I think good cinematography, I don't really, if it's a good film in general, like things like that don't, like you don't sit there and think, man, this editing is fantastic in the middle of the movie, right? And I don't sit there and think the cinematography is necessarily fantastic in the middle of the movie. It's usually after a second or third viewing or hearing someone talk about it, and then you start paying attention to that thing. But what does stand out to me is bad cinematography.
Yeah.
I remember watching a low budget, well, I assume it had to be a low budget film. It was some Armageddon type film. And the lighting just stood out. The camera work just stood out. Everything just stood out as obnoxious. And you're like, this is looks like something I would have done when I was 12 years old. Like how, it's like you spent no time or thought, and it totally distracted from the story. So good editing, good cinematography, I think doesn't take away from the film. It doesn't distract. It helps tell the story. And then later you kind of look behind the curtain and say, wow, I see why this was such a great film because of these different layers, cinematography being one of them. But bad sound, bad cinematography, bad acting, you know, those things jump out to you and then distract you from enjoying the film.
Absolutely. And I would say for me, sound is the biggest hindrance. If sound is bad, I won't watch it, just because, I mean, I can kind of handle the cinematography if it's bad or the editing if it's bad, but if the sound is bad, I won't watch it. I can't, it's terrible. Example I want to give, is I'd like to give you two. One, I want to talk about Jojo Rabbit. If you haven't seen Jojo Rabbit, it's just such a phenomenal film. It's confusing at the beginning because you feel like they're, you know, deifying Hitler, which they were not, but you understand what they were doing after you get further into it. It's brilliant because it is absolutely stunningly beautiful, and how it is shot, how it is colored, how it is lit, how it is framed, makes you feel things, and it makes you pay attention to things. So the one example I was going to give is they choose to shoot the mother's shoes. And this theme of the mom is, in a sense, highlighted by the showing of her shoes. And her shoes are these 1940 red and white shoes that really stand out and are, you know, particular to her. And they have incredible meaning in the beginning, middle, and end of the film. And so that is, you know, in conjunction with the director, but a cinematographer usually, the DP, the director of photography, will have thought about how they want the audience to feel, how that shot is set up, and what they're going to do with that shot throughout the, you know, shooting of the film in order to carry the feeling through. So anyway, that's one positive example. One curious example for me, I don't know if you guys have been watching Inventing Anna, but it's a new series on Netflix, and it's fascinating to me, how they choose to shoot some things. And one in particular that stood out to me as I was watching it this week was there's a shot where the journalist is talking with Anna in prison and they're shooting. You know what I'm talking about, Jason? They're shooting over her shoulder through this tiny little narrow band. So it's like you're sitting on Anna's shoulder. It's not even like you're Anna looking at, you know, the writer. It's that you are a third person in the room peeking behind her shoulder. And I'm so curious as to why they chose to go in that direction. And if I wasn't a filmmaker, I wouldn't be thinking that. I would be feeling something there in that moment. But it just goes to show the power of the director of photography. He is as important as the editor or the director or the sound, you know, department. So anyway, those are my examples. Now, Mindy, I want to ask you, as a cinematographer or rising cinematographer, talk to me about one of your favorite things, or, you know, one that you hate.
Yeah, man, I feel like as someone who works in camera department, that's a really loaded question and I'm going to be judged for it. But one movie where I really love the cinematography is Secret Life of Walter Mitty. There's a lot there. You know, they shot in Iceland. So, you know, just those beautiful vistas, the light of those outdoor scenes, so much of it. I just really fell in love with that style. But there's also the difference between the way the scenes are shot outside when he's on his adventure versus inside. It feels much more claustrophobic when he's in the corporate environment, that sort of thing. And so they made some really particular choices that led to that. And interestingly, I was listening to a podcast this morning with the cinematographer of a series that's on HBO right now called The Gilded Age. And he was talking about how he's made his choices with both composition and lensing and a few other things. So The Gilded Age, broadly speaking, is this battle between old wealth and new wealth in 1920s New York, I think. When he shoots the scenes with the characters who represent old money in New York, he chose anamorphic lenses, and he's much more formal in his composition. The camera never tilts, and everything feels much more structured, which is very much how their lives were and how their attitude is. And then he actually switches to spherical lenses for shooting the new money New York, which I haven't heard a ton of people talk about switching between anamorphic and spherical within the same piece. And so that was just a really interesting discussion. He was talking about how he creates more space for them, how he allows himself more freedom with camera movement. There's a lot more camera movement when it comes to those people. I often don't notice these things until I watch something a second time through. I really try to let myself experience a story the first time through, because I found when I was in college, I got way too analytical and I just couldn't enjoy film anymore because I wasn't experiencing it. And so I'm still on my first time through The Gilded Age. I don't think the entire series is out yet. So I hadn't gone back with a critical eye, although I really enjoyed the way that I was drawn into the story. And there was a painterly aspect to some of the scenes that felt like it really fit the period, that sort of time. So that's kind of two examples on the same theme of showing two very different attitudes and some of what went into making that. I would love to hear an interview with the cinematographer of Walter Mitty too. I need to go see if there's one out there because I really enjoyed their work on that.
Well, I'll tell you, I know the stuntman that was Ben Stiller's stuntman, Greg Fitzpatrick, and he knows everybody on that film. So I'll ask him and see if he can get you a one-on-one.
Oh man, that would be incredible. That would be incredible. Yeah, that was a movie that surprised me how much I love it. I was sick one day and it just was something to watch and I put it on and it was immediately drawn in, and I've watched it multiple times and I love the soundtrack. I love the film. I love the storyline, all of it.
We had Greg Fitzpatrick in our house, I think last year. We watched it as a family. And so he would go through every episode and show us and tell us how he did the stunts and how it was made. And it, when you get that behind the scenes of a movie that you love, there's nothing like that. That's super cool.
That's really cool. Also, he has a dangerous job. So that's a lot of commitment right there to be a stuntman.
For sure.
Well, hey, speaking of jobs, let's take a deeper dive into camera work, shall we? And Mindy, we want to rely on you. When you talk about the camera department, you know, there's different roles. You know, what are the jobs in the camera department?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's something I've been figuring out over the last year or so. So I come from a background of what people would call video production, and it's much less structured, usually much smaller teams. And, you know, kind of came in with the idea of, you know, I think movies have too many people in their camera departments. I don't understand why it takes so many people. I mean, I do this with one or two people. Why do they have 10, you know? But as I have started working on higher level productions and working my way up in the camera department on those higher level productions, I've really come to understand why there are so many roles and what those are. So brief overview, the director of photography or the DP is the head of the camera department, and they often hire the people below them. And so they are also the liaison between the director and the entire camera department. So they are the person who takes the director's vision and figures out technically, how are we going to execute this? How are we going to make it look like the director sees it in their head? What cameras are we going to use? What sort of lighting? They take the first stab at lighting. I'll talk about G&E a little bit too. They are the ones who really execute that. But they are the person who takes kind of the artistic creative vision and figures out, okay, how do we break that down into the very practical parts of cameras, lenses, lights, framing, composition, all of that. And then below them, you often have both camera operators and camera assistants. They have two different roles. Camera operators on a larger shoot, sometimes the DP will operate. It totally depends on the DP. Sometimes they like to sit with the director. Sometimes they sit with the DIT, who I'll talk about in a minute. But on multi-camera productions, you'll have A cam operator, B cam operator, C cam operator, et cetera. On smaller productions, you may just have the DP who's actually has their hands on the camera and is making the camera move and choosing the shots, or you may have a camera operator who's doing that. Often they're on a headset with the DP, and the DP is telling them generally what they want, but the operator also gets to make some creative choices about framing and movement and that sort of thing. And then you have the first AC. A camera first AC is the kind of administrative head of the entire camera department. They take what the DP has told them, and they make sure that all the parts and pieces and people other than the operators are in line to make that happen. And so for ACAM first AC on a major production, starts making sure that the rental houses have what they need and will have it on the day. They go and prepare the cameras at the rental houses. If it's a multi-camera shoot, they might take their other first ACs with them. But they go, so when you arrive at a rental house, the camera's in pieces. You're handed a ton of cases that all have pieces in them. You have your lens case, you have your camera case, you have about 15 different pieces that are going to go onto the camera to make it function. It's not like they just hand you a Panavision camera and say, okay, see you, bye. You have to build it the way that your operators want it. And every operator has some specifics about what they want and how they want it put on the camera. And then you have to test it all and make sure it works. Rental houses test the gear, but the ACs are the ones who are responsible for showing up and saying, yes, I've checked all this gear and it's going to function like it's supposed to. And the batteries are charged and all of this. So there's really like dozens of little pieces for every camera that's on a shoot. And the first AC makes sure that all that is ready to go. Then you have the second AC, and sometimes they get to go on prep, sometimes they don't, depends on the production and the budget. But on set, The second AC is responsible for making sure that the memory cards are ready for the camera, that they've been formatted, that the camera doesn't run out of memory while it's going in. And I'm talking digital production because that's what I'm most familiar with. I'll mention some film stuff, but I am not a celluloid expert, and so I can't speak to that. But second AC handles the memory cards. They handle the batteries. It's their job to make sure that nothing dies on set, whether it's a camera or a monitor, that sort of thing. So they've got a bunch of batteries they're making sure are charged, and they're swapping those out on regular intervals. And they're assisting the first AC with whatever they need. So on set, the first AC is often also a focus puller, meaning they have a little hand unit with a knob on it, and they are in charge of making sure that the focus is sharp on every shot. You know, the really experienced ACs can do this by distance. They'll go, oh, that person's 6 feet from the camera, and they'll know right where on their knob 6 feet is, and they can nail it that way. With digital, especially 4K and above, it's getting harder to be right on. I've talked to some ACs who are like, yeah, with film, you can get away with pulling even without looking at a monitor. But with the, you know, increased resolution, they want to be able to see it too, because there's a difference between like 6 feet and 6 feet a quarter inch, you know, and so they're there making sure, you know, the eyes are sharp. If the actor moves, they can follow that movement, that sort of thing. If it's a dolly shot, they're tracking with the dolly as it goes. Yeah, and sometimes there's three planes of movement, you know, the dolly's coming in, the camera's moving up, and it's tilting or something like that. And so they're following all of that, making sure it's sharp. And they're also kind of the person you go to if you need to talk to someone outside a camera department. You go to your first AC and you say, hey, such and such is going on, and they'll know who in the other departments to go talk to about that issue. There's a pretty structured chain of command on big shoots about who you talk to about what. And then depending on the shoot, you may also have a media manager, and that's someone who's responsible for downloading the information off the cards. And like Christian was talking about with the DCP file, you need to make sure that you have backups. So industry standard is at least 2 drives. So you're putting everything on at least 2 hard drives. Sometimes there's more than that. I know when I shoot, I do 2 hard drives, and if possible, if I have enough cards, I keep my cards too until I know that the footage has arrive safely. I also try not to put the drives on the same plane flying back. I try and make sure that, you know, if the plane goes down, we still have the footage. So media manager handles that, or sometimes you have someone who's a DIT, and they're also responsible for the cards, but they have skills beyond that. They know how to color correct on set. They'll help you develop LUTs, which is a abbreviation for lookup table, which is a color correction file format. So they'll be developing those so that you can look at your footage on set and see how it will look once it's color corrected. Sometimes they do some assistant editor type stuff and help prepare the dailies, which is the shots the director and some others, often producers, want to look at, the DP want to look at the end of each day to see what they've gotten. So the DIT handles all that and possibly some more stuff. I am not a DIT. It's one area I probably won't work in because I don't want that much responsibility. And I'm not quite that techy. That's a very, very specialized part of camera department. Sometimes you have someone who's called VTR, and they're responsible for just making sure all the monitors on set work, that they're all connected via either wireless or wired connections to the cameras, so that not only can the camera operator see what they see, but the DP can see it and the director can see it. If it's a commercial shoot, the client can see it. There's so many people who want to be able to see everything that's happening on the other side of those cameras. Sometimes you have a video utility, they kind of do the same thing plus whatever else needs to be doing. And if you're lucky, you get a camera PA who does whatever anybody needs them to do and gets coffee and crafty and all that stuff. Because honestly, in my experience, camera department doesn't have a lot of extra time because they need to be first up and going so that the director and the DP and the gaffer and everybody can make educated decisions. So the camera has to get up very quickly and be able to be looked through so that everybody can start making their creative decisions. And then you can't break the camera down until everybody's, you know, all the action's finished. And so it's a lot of get it up quickly, make sure it all works the way it's supposed to, and then move on. But there's usually not a lot of downtime for camera department.
So that's a lot.
It's a lot. And that would be a very large production. And I should also specify, I'm speaking from a non-union perspective. I am a non-union AC in Nashville.
So let's say you're a young filmmaker and you want, you know, to get a crew together. You know, how do you find good people to shoot a film?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a couple different perspectives to come at this. One is, who can you afford? So we're talking people working high levels in this. They want their day rates, and those day rates are not cheap. And so, if you're wanting to hire, you're going to need some money. And it comes down to, you know, who can you either afford to hire, or who can you interest enough in your project to, you know, for this to be something they want to work on. I will say with that, though, it's not cool to ask people to work for free. It's really not. There needs to be some exchange of value there. So whether it's you're giving someone a chance to work in a position that they need more experience in to really be at a level where they can get paid for that, or if you swap off with some friends, you know, they work on your project, you work on theirs, that sort of thing. There's ways to trade value, but there definitely needs to be value to be had, and exposure is not adequate value. Promising someone, you'll get so much exposure from this project, that's not cool either. This is part of the struggle of being a young or a early in your career filmmaker is, you know, wanting to get the best quality you can, and being limited by your budget. And so, you know, it's you got to just know who your friends are, know what your network is, find ways to provide value some way or another, get creative with it, and be willing to invest some money. You're gonna have to spend some money somewhere, and whether it's on gear or labor or what. But you know, you can work with less experienced people and know that it's probably going to take longer. And there's probably gonna be more mistakes. You can work with a smaller camera department, maybe just a DP and an AC who does everything and media manages or something. And you know, do as much as you can afford, but realize you're probably not going to have the same bandwidth that a large crew has and the same perfection that a large crew has. And everything's going to just take longer. Yeah, it's this whole, you've heard, you know, you can, you have to pick two out of three. You can have it fast, good, or cheap. So you can have it fast and good, but it won't be cheap. you can have it cheap and good, but it won't be fast, you know, that sort of thing. I feel like that very much applies here, and you just have to figure out what your trade-offs are and what serves your story best. But always take good care of your people. You always have to take good care of your people.
I remember Sandy Gordon, that was the first major lesson she taught me as a producer, was the camera department, including the gaffers, which are the electricians.
Gaffers in charge of lighting.
Lighting, sorry.
Yeah.
And the electricians and all of the people that are in charge of the electric stuff. All of those people are doing the heavy lifting. They're actually physically doing stuff. And the people that I've met in those departments, they don't like to take breaks. When they're in the zone, they want to stay in the zone, and they won't stop to go to the bathroom. They won't stop to get water. They won't stop to eat. And so, you know, Sandy basically said to me, you really have to make sure that breaks are built in and that you're paying attention to what they're doing. Otherwise, they're just going to keep going. And I think people in those departments can feel that love from a producer, or they can also feel taken advantage of. So that's a very good note, I think, Mindy.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, some of it's, we're all very aware of who's waiting on us. Any experienced crew member who, you know, really cares about a project, we know that if we don't get this done quickly, someone else is going to be held up. We also know it's going to make our day longer, you know? And so we're all very motivated to keep that going. And speaking to the heavy lifting part, so as an AC, it's not uncommon for me to put in 3 to 4 miles a day of walking on set. And that's usually with heavy gear. I recently got a cart, so my cart is super helpful now. I can push a lot of things on wheels now, but tripods, high-end cameras, those lenses, they're not light. You know, cameras 15, 20 pounds easy and up, depending on what sort of camera it is and what sort of glass you have on it. So, you know, that's often on someone's shoulder. The tripod weighs
in that range too. So heavy. Mm-hmm. And you also, like, that reminds me of the weather. So I remember I was working with a camera woman. We were doing an Inside Edition thing and we got stuck in snowpocalypse. I think it was 2011. And we were supposed to ride with a snowplow and that didn't end up happening. So we were walking around doing interviews and I had to carry the tripod in, you know, a foot of snow. And that happens a lot. Camera people are out in the elements, whether it's snow or rain or hot sun. You know, directors can sit underneath an umbrella or, you know, inside a truck, you know, because all you have to do is look at a monitor. But I mean, these guys and girls are out on the front lines and it's a physically demanding job.
It is. It is. So that's another reason to take good care of your people. And, you know, a lot of people in this field are in it because they love it. And so they're going to do their best for you because they love what they're doing. And anything you can do to take care of them is going to pay itself back to you in dividends of them being able to do their job better. You know, if I'm not dehydrated, I'm going to do a whole lot better at the work that I'm doing if I'm dehydrated and hungry. You know, so I haven't actually gotten to work on a project yet that has the full crew. So for me on mostly commercial jobs right now, I'm working with a DP, a first AC. I'm often second AC because my focus pulling skills aren't quite up to par yet. And in Nashville as a second AC, I often media manage as well. I have some friends who are ACs in LA and they would not be happy knowing that. So the LA ACs would be like, no, that's a totally separate position. It should be a different hire. And it should, you know, but our budgets aren't where they could be to make that happen. And so it often ends up being combined with second AC on some smaller jobs. But you're taking a risk. You know, my attention is split between making sure the cards get dumped and making sure that nothing's dying on set and running out of battery power. And so, you know, there's more room for error because of that. And also I'm not a DIT. I don't have quite the knowledge on that someone else could, to make sure that was done, you know, more perfectly, but yeah, camera crews come in all sizes. Sometimes you just have a DP on set, for really small projects. And then sometimes you have the whole slew. I named plus a whole G&E department, which is the gaffer who's in charge of how the lighting looks, electricians who are in charge of making sure everything is powered correctly and you're not going to blow any fuses, and sometimes setting up massive generators to make sure you have electricity in the first place, and grips who move things and build things. And this is where you start seeing names like best boy and best girl and key grip. And it's those names in the credits where you're like, what does that person do? You know, but they're making sure everything is built and powered, and the gaffer's in charge of making sure that the lighting feels like the director of photography has asked for it to feel. So they're the person who comes in and says, okay, I need so many of these fixtures and so many of those fixtures, and we're going to fly these up here and we're going to, you know, put these on such and such percentage. And then they work with the director of photography to get dialed in for exactly what they want so that the director's vision is then realized.
I mean, you know, Josh, what does it do to your ears when you hear all of these specific roles and things they do and all of the people there?
What do my ears do?
Your brain.
No, it's overwhelming. Yeah, I'm just imagining all these people. It takes a lot. I mean, if you stick around for the credits for any film, there's a gajillion names on there, and you're just talking about the camera crew, right? You know, so it's overwhelming, and someone's got to be the leader of all that. And that's an ambitious, maybe it makes me tired. That's what it does. It makes me tired because there's a lot to be done.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's, you know, talking to filmmakers early in their career, it's really about finding the balance between what you can afford and like the level of excellence or perfection you expect. you know, and there's people who pull off amazing things with tiny little crews, you know, and those are really amazing creative endeavors because you're doing so much with so little.
Speaking of that, Mindy, yeah. If you look at The Girl Who Wore Freedom, which I hope everyone listening has, we had ADP who did everything. He didn't do DIT, but even our DIT guy didn't do a DIT.
I'm glad you ended up with a film then, because that's risky.
It was a nightmare. It was utter nightmare that we did not have anybody doing DIT. We didn't do dailies. I mean, we just couldn't with what we were doing, the budget that we had. But I mean, imagine, I mean, our film is beautiful. Our film is beautiful. It was so well shot. And it really was because of Corey Lillard. He did everything. And, you know, my mind is blown by that. You're right. You can get really good stuff, you know, but like I said before, there were a lot of mistakes made as well. And we did pick the best of, you know, of everything. So,
yeah, I think based off what I've heard you say about some choices you had to make in your edit, like there are things that could have been different with a larger crew because you would have had the bandwidth to see it on set and to fix it in the moment. Yeah. And that's really one of the biggest sacrifices you're looking at is, well, other than like a DIT not doing their job and possibly not having your footage show up, you know, because that's a problem. But it really is that ability to have time and bandwidth on set to fix it then, to make something happen then, so that you're not in the edit room later going, oh, I wish we had, you know, or, oh, that shot wasn't quite as sharp as it should have been, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Awesome. All right, Josh. Well,
great stuff, Mindy. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Before we wrap up, we're going to do a quick mini segment. I'll be honest with you. I don't know what we call it anymore.
Now it's deja vu, docu-view? No. Now it's time for our new segment, docu-view deja vu. Docu-view deja vu. There we go.
Okay. So I was wrong. I was right. I didn't know.
Docu-view deja vu. Thank you, Jeff Kurtnacker. All right. So I'm going to start with Jason. We haven't heard you talk a lot. So talk to us about a documentary today that you've thought about.
Yeah. So this documentary, I think it's kind of fitting that we're talking about this on the cinematography episode, because this film, in my opinion, does not have great cinematography. And I think part of it is because it was really early in the digital revolution. So this movie is Inside Job from 2010. It won Best Documentary Film in 2010 and won the Oscar. Have any of you seen this movie?
I have not, but I've wanted to.
Okay, so it's about the 2008 financial crisis and how it happened. And so they interview all these really fascinating people, but it's shot on a Red One digital camera, and everything is super deep focus. So like, and it all feels like it's shot on a crazy long zoom lens. So like, oh, we're going to interview this guy in his office, and it looks like he's, you know, got his back up against a bookcase, and you can read every single title on the bookcase behind him. And it just, it's visually distracting from a fantastic story about the 2008 financial crisis and how all these different people and actors really came together. Now it's cut together with news footage and B-roll and all these other things too. But when it cuts the interviews, it always distracted me. Every time I've watched this film, I've just been like, I just get lost in looking at, you know, this guy who's in, you know, what looks like an airport for some reason, and you can see all the way down the hallway behind him, and it's in sharp focus, and it feels really digital, and it doesn't feel like it was colored well, and it won best documentary at the Academy Awards that year.
Story is king, my friend.
Yep, exactly. And it is a fantastic story. I've watched it several times, and just thinking about it again makes me want to go rewatch it. It was actually originally shot in 2K on a Red One. So it's a very odd, it's when they were trying to figure out what digital really was and how you can make films with it.
Cool. And where can you watch it now?
I have it on Amazon, but I think I bought it. So let me just dig around and see if I can find it.
All right. And while he does that, Mindy, why don't you tell us what you came with today?
Yeah. So this is a film I've wanted to mention for a couple episodes now, and I just keep forgetting the name of it. It is called Blowing Up. That's with an N on the end, not with a G. And it is the amazing story of a particular courtroom in New York City, actually the Queens Criminal Court. And a judge and a team of advocates there who really changed the way that women facing prosecution for prostitution were treated in that court. And it's an amazing story of combination of justice and mercy and advocacy. And it's one of those stories that you'd never really hear about unless you happen to see the film about it. And that's one of my favorite things about documentary is getting this intense inside look at a story about a group of people making a difference that you'd never hear about. Otherwise, there's no way you'd like just run into them. And so, you know, obviously not family friendly with the subject matter, but really well told story, amazingly compelling characters. Cinematography is an interesting angle on this one because it's a lot of cinema verite in the courthouse, and you don't have a lot of control over your lighting and things like that in the courthouse. They also have to protect the identity of some of the women that they interview. So that's always an interesting thing to look at from a cinematographic perspective as well. But again, story is king, and I really think they did the best they could with what they had and tell a really amazing story about I guess redemption is kind of the key there in this story. So it's available for rent or purchase on Amazon. Sometimes it cycles through Prime. So if you have Prime, it might pop up as available there, but definitely worth, I think it's like $3 to rent it. Yeah, $2.99. If you're looking for a really well-told documentary story, go check that one out.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm going to give you mine, and then Josh, I'll let you go last, and then you can wrap us up. Mine is called...
We lost you.
Yeah, everybody got muted somehow.
Yeah, we all became muted at the same time.
Christian's watching
Christian,
a movie.
You're still muted.
She was watching a movie earlier while we were trying to have a conversation and just totally tuned us out.
I don't know what happened. My space bar wasn't working. I don't know how that happened.
And somehow I think you muted all of us too.
That's crazy. Okay, well, I'm going to share with you a beautifully shot documentary called My Octopus Teacher. And it is a phenomenal film, mostly shot underwater. You can find it on Netflix, and it is a beautiful story. So it's a story about how this filmmaker was taking time off to really reevaluate his life and slow things down. And he ended up making friends with an octopus who really taught him to look at his life and life in general in a completely different perspective. And because it was shot underwater, there's just so many things about this film. I could talk forever about how it was shot and the story and on a deep spiritual level, the truths that were communicated to me were profound. So, My Octopus Teacher, look it up on Netflix. All right, Josh, you're up.
All right, I'm bringing the 2018 documentary about Mr. Rogers, Won't You Be My Neighbor?
Yes.
Love that.
There's two films that came out about Mr. Rogers, this documentary, and then the one with Tom Hanks. The one with Tom Hanks I thought was great, but if I had to watch one again, it would definitely be the documentary.
Agree.
That one was very powerful. So if you haven't seen it, you can watch it on HBO Max or rent it on, I know you can rent it on Apple TV right now. So, but excellent, excellent film. And especially if you grew up watching him, but even if you didn't, it's still worth seeing.
Yeah, I love it because Fred Rogers talks for himself. And so you can really get behind the man when you watch that documentary. It's great. Good one. Thanks for bringing that, Josh.
Yep. Yep. Of course. And speaking of thanks, we want to thank our listeners for being here today and dealing with Christian's technical difficulties.
Yeah. Sorry.
I'm just teasing. But thank you, Mindy Cook, for being here. and sharing all of your knowledge. I hope you all are taking notes. And again, to our listeners, thank you for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everyone has a story to tell, and you can be the one to tell it.
Yes, you can. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you for listening, donating, and following along on our journey. We are supported by generous donations from people just like you. To make a donation, visit thegirlwhowarefreedom.com or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/documentaryfirst. To learn more about our other works in progress, visit documentaryfirst.com or follow Documentary First on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Documentary First, edited and mixed by Jason Hoban, with music by Jeff Kurtenacker.